Hello and welcome to the Ecosystemic Futures Podcast presented by NASA Convergent Aeronautics Solutions Project in collaboration with Shoshanworks, a global firm helping organizations and nations navigate ecosystemic transformation. As our world is increasingly digital and interconnected, ecosystemic models are reshaping society, industry, economy, and policy, and reframing how we build for resilient futures. I'm Diane Finkhausen, CEO of Shoshanworks, and joined today by my co-host, Anna Brady Estevez. Anna, welcome.
Thanks for having us, Diane. And Lou, thank you so much for joining. I'm really eager to get into your insights and background introduction. But first, I just wanted to provide both the listeners and you with the context, because you and I have met in the past, but the context on why we're engaging this conversation today. So I co-chair the U.S. Space Economy Working Group, work with a number of tremendous colleagues across the interagency. One who just stepped on, Larry Forsley, is coming in from NASA and who's also an entrepreneur. But I would say, and I'm also over at the Small Business Administration in their Office of Innovation and Investments, Investments and Innovation. And so speaking on behalf of interests from investors, and then at NSF, we fund all fields of technology. And that has included for several years things that turn out to probably be UAP adjacent technology. So we are open all fields of innovation. And what we found is that a significant percentage of entrepreneurs and inventors have seen things, have knowledge. And we're really here to have the conversation about the people who want to build things and who want to fund things. So we always love the conversation and bringing people into the what's here, what's not here, and some of that ongoing. But going straight to the what do people need to know who are building actively in this space, and what do people need to understand in terms of whether to build and whether to invest? So you have been one of the most prominent, in terms of your reach, leaders in the disclosure movement on UAP technology, and you've served your country in the armed forces, so tremendous service to country. And we do know, both through our innovation work and our government work, some of the people who you worked with on the UAP task force. So we certainly can say, yes, we've heard that you played a very important role over there on what is it like an acknowledged government initiative that's very public now or somewhat public. So could you just give us a brief sense of your backgrounds and then we just dive straight into what you know on the UAPs that you want to share?
Yeah, sure. Well, first of all, thank you ladies for having me. It is truly my honor and privilege to be with you here today. As far as my background, kind of grew up as a young man, a bit of a dysfunctional family when I was younger, decided after college to, my background was in medicine, microbiology and immunology, and parasitology, that is the study of parasites and microorganisms and diseases. I went into the Army after that for a short stint, was therefore quickly recruited after that into some special activities programs. Spent the rest of my career as a senior intelligence officer and counterintelligence special agent, which means that most of my time was investigating capital crime, such as terrorism and espionage and things like that. In early 2009, I really, for the first time, got involved in the topic that now everybody's talking about, which is UAP or in the vernacular UFOs. I wasn't necessarily prone to science fiction as a kid. I like to tell people I was more of a G.I. Joe kid than a Star Wars kid. And so didn't have any particular interest in the topic at all until I actually entered into the Pentagon's program that studied UAP or again, UFOs in the vernacular. And people are surprised to hear that, yes, we spent a lot of taxpayer money doing research into this topic, commissioned multiple studies, 37 academic studies with very renowned institutions on advanced scientific principles to include Alcubierre type warp drives, space-time matrix engineering, and things like that. So it wasn't really just a bunch of hobbyists. We were actually paid to do what we were doing. And in 2017, I resigned in my position in protest because the Pentagon and the intelligence community, which is I'm a product of both, I didn't feel was doing enough about this topic. You said you had a guest before, Ryan Graves, one of the pilots of an F-18, and he can tell you stories where these UAP have literally split formations, combat formations down the middle. So there is an air flight safety issue here. Now, as we're seeing with the drone flap that's happening now over New Jersey and quite frankly, California and Maryland and Virginia and New York and a bunch of other states and other countries like Germany and the UK, it's a problem. The bottom line is we simply do not have complete air domain awareness. What is in our skies? We don't know where stuff is coming from. We don't know where it's going to. And in some cases, we don't even know who's behind it. So there's a
And Lou, just to put a date and time on this, because I know some people listen, this is December 13th, 2024. So when we're talking about some of these recent things, we've also heard from others that they've been ongoing for several years, and in some cases, same time period of the year.
Yeah. And it was back in 2019 and 2020 when Colorado and Nebraska experienced the same thing that New Jersey is right now. And even local and state law enforcement and federal law enforcement was involved. There's videos and pictures and audio recordings of these drones or whatever you want to call them, these craft, these vehicles, and with no apparent sponsor. So again, this highlights the issue that we frankly do not have good domain awareness or situation awareness of what's in our skies.
And I know there are things that you've worked on for years where there might be things that you saw personally, and there might have been programs where you're kind of more primary or secondary source, which I know you're also one of the most hyper-connected people in the country on this. So realize some of there's things that we know over time and that are kind of solid, and then there might be things today that the situation will evolve on the current stuff. But are there things that you feel like we really know about the current situation in New Jersey, Maryland, New York, Texas, Virginia, Florida, Illinois, Oregon? Perhaps there are some other states you would add to this list that are ongoing right now. Are there the things that you feel like we know for sure that you would share?
Yeah, let's look at some of the commonalities. We know that there is an interest in some of our sensitive military installations and our nuclear equities, particularly some of our nuclear power generation plants. That's an established fact now. You can look at DHS SAR reporting, suspicious activity reporting. There's bulletins coming out all day, every day for local and state law enforcement to be on the lookout for these things. In some cases, these things have been described as being the size of a small SUV or even larger. So we're not talking about hobbyists. We're not talking about quadcopters or perhaps maybe your local realtor trying to get some drone footage on a piece of property. We're talking about something very sophisticated that has a loiter ability of hours. So think about that, right? Power generation. You talk about something very large and that has the ability to maintain power for up to 5-6 hours, if not longer. And also during that time, traverse an extended distance. So if you know anything about how RF radio frequency works, and if I wanted to, let's say this is my little drone that I'm flying, most drones have a line of sight as far as their limitations in being able to send and receive signals. So you can imagine as a hobbyist, you can only fly a drone a few miles before you lose signal strength, and eventually the curvature of the earth restricts your ability to actually communicate with a drone, which can be anywhere between 9 to 11 miles out. These drones seem to defy that. These drones are flying in formation. They are communicating with each other in some cases, coordinating their efforts, and their longevity, their loiterability, and their size does not fit in normal routine categories of what a drone should be. They're not landing anywhere that we know of. They're not taking off from anywhere we know of. And if you're talking about a large SUV-sized drone with the capability of over the horizon, you're really limiting yourself now to state-sponsored type countries that can pull that off, because you need infrastructure, you need resources, you need people to do that. You need a very well-coordinated and synchronized effort, because you have to have something repeating a signal. So if I'm going to fly over the horizon, I need now either an aircraft or something tall like a tower or perhaps even a satellite to retransmit that signal in real time to my drone and back and forth for telemetry purposes and whatnot. So it's a very sophisticated capability. Then you have talking about refueling. These drones are electrically powered, which they probably are, because liquid propellant is going to be like gasoline or some sort of combustible is going to be too heavy for that platform to loiter. Remember, you're talking about, 7.5 pounds per gallon. You're really talking about something that is using electricity, probably some sort of battery storage, if it's a drone. So there's a lot of things here that we are beginning to realize that don't make sense in a conventional sort of way. Now, what we do also know is that we're in the middle of a very tense situation with Russia and the Ukraine issue. Politics aside, they are both using drones. Both sides are using drones in a weaponized fashion, meaning they are taking small drones and they are placing explosives on them or other weapon systems and using them to attack each other. Is it possible this is a potential show of force by Russia saying, look what we can do. You know, we can fly our drones over your cities anytime we want. Imagine if we wanted to put some sort of capability on there. Or is it our own drones? Is it a U.S. government sponsored effort? Maybe someone like Department of Energy, maybe they've got, and by the way, this is notional, so I'm not saying this is the case, just it's a could be. Maybe there's some threat reporting that somewhere there's a weapons of mass destruction somewhere in the United States, continental United States. And so you have these agencies using these large drones to, quote unquote, sniff out any type of chemical or radiological weapon that perhaps could have been put here as some sort of insurance policy, so to speak. Or it could be something else as well. We do know that some people are reporting these things maneuvering coming out of the water, transmedium, and also flying at very great speeds. And the lights that we are seeing in some cases don't match navigational light patterns that you would see on a normal aircraft, like, say, a Cessna 172 or even a commercial airplane. So there's a lot of things that we are beginning to find out, but every time we learn a little piece of information, more questions are resulting from our efforts to investigate this. We do know that it is worldwide. It is not isolated to New Jersey. As you mentioned just now, there's multiple states involved, and there are multiple agencies involved, and now there's multiple countries involved as well.
So which other countries are involved, Lou?
So I just came back from the United Kingdom, where they had an issue some time ago at Manchester Airport, but then now some of the joint military bases. So we have some military bases where we have some equities there. I won't go into specifics as to what those equities are, but you can probably fill in the blank. They are very sensitive. And now you have the Royal Air Force, RAF, and you also have certain elements within British intelligence and UK MOD, Ministry of Defense, involved, trying to figure out what's going on with these drones over our controlled airspace there in the UK. Germany just reported some headlines today in some national news that Germany now, over NATO bases, NATO is now beginning to get concerned and scramble aircraft as a result. So this is not new. This is happening. It continues to happen.
And sorry, Lou, just to, because it's us, we're hearing about some countries where we have bases in Europe. Are there other examples kind of outside of Europe where we're seeing us? Are there any other like non-U.S. allies or strong U.S. allies that are experiencing this?
There are. The reporting is a little bit more sparse. There are several countries that I have known that I've been made aware of through some reporting, particularly in Asia. I won't say which ones yet because I still work. This is through official sources, so I don't want to burn those individuals or those sources. But this is a problem now. This is a significant problem. In fact, believe it or not, leading up to the issue in Ukraine with Russia, there was a tremendous amount of drone activity that both sides were witnessing that neither side claimed responsibility for. So this is an issue. Now, we also have to keep in mind, you said something about space economy, and space is really the future. I worked for a while at U.S. Space Force on this particular topic, actually for Space Force, looking at UAP after I left ATIP. We have some of the best capabilities out there that we are using to identify these things, not just in our atmosphere, but potentially in low Earth orbit, LEO orbit, possibly beyond, and even underwater. But let me, if I can, just emphasize something here as far as the future for space. Space is the future. It is where we will all go to eventually. We have to, for multiple reasons. But if you look at it, just the economics of it, it's been estimated just in the asteroid belt between Mars and Jupiter, there is more precious resources out there than there, if you were to put a value on it, than all the money that has ever been printed in the entire world altogether combined.
And that's a great point, Lou. And I think the takeaway, because I've seen that financial analysis with the platinum group metals, is less that it's like 80 trillion or however many trillions of dollars, but it's more like unlimited those metals, right? So you probably would tank the price, if you had.
Yeah, someone mentioned
that number, but abundance.
The last number I saw was 10 to the 18th power. So 18 zeros. I don't know what number
that is. We wouldn't pay that much for it at that point, but we would have as much of it as we needed for sure.
Correct. Yes, correct. So again, I've got some very good friends and colleagues that work at NASA. I have a bit of history as well myself, my early career on some of their projects, working some joint projects. So space is where it's at. And I think my very dear friend, Mike Gold, who actually worked on the UAP task force as a NASA representative and also one of the Artemis mission managers here, he did something very bold in November when he testified before Congress alongside myself and several other of my colleagues on the 13th of November. For the first time, I heard NASA boldly stating that we need to look into this topic. We cannot allow stigma and taboo to cloud our eagerness to figure out this incredible enigma, this incredible mystery that we now find ourselves in the midst of. And that was a very refreshing tone to hear, because NASA has always been built on impossible challenges. Let's not forget that Kennedy, just not too few many decades ago, said that we're going to go to the moon, and not because it's easy, because it's hard. And what happened within 10 years, we did just that. And not only that, but let me remind your audience here that over 6,200 industries, not products, industries came out as a result of just 10 years of competition between the U.S. and then Soviet Union to see who was going to get on the moon, who was going to be in space first, who was going to be able to develop things. Things like the LED light bulb, right? Life-changing things, the CAT scan. Think of where our society would be without these wonderful inventions that all were a result of 10 years of the space race, right?
It's great. It's great to hear you say that. And one of the things that we were saying recently is, if you wonder if there's intelligent life on other planets or other bodies, like the moon, NASA has brought us humanity there. The private sector is bringing us there. So we're going to Mars. We'll put humans on Mars as the United States and some of our partners. And so that's coming. So the question is whether it's already happening, or, but we will do it. There will be that expansion of life onto other planets. And to your point on the industries and the products, we very much started this conversation based on kind of the, what can we build? And we find, so the environments that we've been engaging across the interagency, across the private sector, hundreds of conversations, I would say, on this topic and related topics. And I have never seen such a high level of interest amongst inventors and innovators. We've also been very surprised to see that a significant percentage of certain groups, say 30-50%, have seen things. So we certainly have heard that the number is probably higher for pilots, but it's pretty high in terms of entrepreneurs, inventors, highly successful people, at least in some of these segmented fields, when there's that willingness to speak. So I don't know if you've seen kind of similarly surprisingly high numbers when people talk to you. Obviously, we don't sometimes they don't speak to who they are, but
yeah, absolutely. I've had members of Congress themselves tell me they've had their own UAP experiences. And interestingly enough, now when I go to the Pentagon, there was a time if you mentioned UFO or UAP, you'd have to whisper it in the back halls of some skiff, probably in a SAPF facility. And now you can have the conversation downstairs in the cafeteria in front of everybody and have an engaging conversation, a rational conversation, without going to ideas of tinfoil hats and Elvis on the mothership, and have a rational conversation of what it means for space exploration. Look, I'll be the first one to tell you, I'm an inventor myself. I have multiple patents under my name. And I believe that this particular topic, and I believe NASA, by the way, is going to help lead the way on this in this conversation, has the ability to transform mankind for the better and irrevocably. I think there are times where humanity is faced with these paradigm-changing moments, and it doesn't happen very often in one's lifetime, but as a species, I would submit to you, it's vital for the very evolution of our species. If we want to evolve from living in a cave, then we have to venture outside the cave at some point. If we want to discover new lands and terra incognita, hidden lands, we have to be willing to sail over the horizon at some point and leave behind what we know and what we're comfortable with. That is the journey of humankind. It always has been. And it's inevitability. In fact, we're very much like a bacteria. We grow or we will stagnate and die.
And you've helped us grow, Lou. So you've really done a lot to advance the conversation. And I do think you've been in some rooms that many people haven't been in. And there's the things, anytime you're in a room, whether it's in a technology that might be export controlled across technology sectors, or whether it's something that's being close held in industry, there's a lot of things that are competitively held. Just, we don't know the ingredients of Coca-Cola amongst, not the ingredients, like the process, right? Amongst many other things. But so could you share with us the things that you say, all right, out of what's shareable, because you get to anchor to some of those very elite programs that there's now things public. What can you share for those that aren't in those rooms?
Yeah, what I can share is the fact that there was an effort by Lockheed Martin, believe it or not, by one of their very senior reps, to offload some of the material, exotic material they had in their possession to one of the groups that I was part of, affiliated with initially, AUSAP and ATIP. The program I was mostly entrenched with was ATIP, but its predecessor was AUSAP. And there is now a document that was approved for release by the Pentagon through the DOPSR, official DOPSR process, where it talks about that conversation where there were people in Lockheed Martin that said, hey, we want to offload this exotic material. We've gone as far as we can as far as understanding how it works, and it's expensive to house it. More and more of these scenarios are becoming public. More and more companies are privately. There's a few others that have reached out to me independently and privately. I'm not going to say their names here because I don't have their permission. The only reason why I mentioned Lockheed was because there's documentation on it that's out in the wild. So I can't control that. And that's now publicly available. But there are other companies that have reached out and said the same thing and said, hey, look, we've kind of backed ourselves in a corner. The government told us never to say anything about this. And now we're being kind of pinned the tail on the donkey. We're kind of being put in a bad spot here because we know what we have, but we've been told for many years not to say it. But now we kind of want to say it because people are going to look at us and really not trust us very well. And keep in mind, these are large corporations that have investors. They have CEOs and presidents and boards that they have to constantly make sure that they're giving value to their investors. That's law.
And that point on value is a great one, because I guess not to name any names here, but we've heard from a variety of sources that there are places and there's availability of things that the origin is presumed to be extraterrestrial. If it's not extraterrestrial, it seems like it's very interesting and valuable because it implies engineering capabilities that are impressive, right? So regardless of where it's from, let's figure out what you can do with it, right? Or what is shareable about what can be done with it. So that's really helpful for you to share that. And for those that hold, whether it's materials advantage or other technology advantage, and sometimes there's a benefit for others building upon that to increase the value. So those who hold information, to the extent that they're able to drive that to productization capabilities beyond what they may or may not have already, that's a significant opportunity. So while there might be things to work through, it seems like whoever has this knowledge or can build this knowledge, there could be a lot there. Would you disagree, agree?
No, I agree completely. And in fact, that's one of the primary motivations from a strictly capitalistic perspective, that we need to get some of this technology and material out of the existing silos and into the hands of individuals that can do something with it. Imagine if the person who invented, I don't know, the soldering capability thought that they're going to keep the technology for themselves, which later on would slow the development of things like Wi-Fi and cellular phones and computers, right? We have to get these things out into the marketplace because that is how humanity thrives. That's how we thrive financially and economically, but it's also how we thrive socially. Look at the right now social media. Look at the fact that we're having this conversation over thousands of miles and simply just electromagnetic radiation that's emanating to a particular thing up in the sky that gets bounced to another one, then down to a ground station. And now here we are having a virtual meeting, right? And yet separated by thousands. Imagine if that technology, that capability was kept sequestered and out of the market. I think it's a travesty. I don't agree with doing business that way, by keeping things super close hold and not letting fair and honest competition be able to maybe do something with it.
Well, and just to see in cases, we never have a guarantee before something's fully out in the market or fully developed, you know, that it is going to have any impact. But like, as we think of a portfolio of disruptive approaches, like we look at single American leaders in a market. So a company like NVIDIA, $3.3 billion. A company like Eli Lilly, $750 billion market cap. So in terms of the solutions, the economic growth and leadership, the abundance, the trade, not to say that any companies do or don't have the ability for those disruptive advantages, but when there's that potential to drive value, and so many of we see the UAP phenomena, like you're saying, okay, propulsion ability to stay in the air, whether it's for 5-6 hours, like what's been seen recently in New Jersey and other states, or if it's Ryan off the coast of Virginia was saying 24 hours for some of these craft, right? The ability to move at ultra fast transport, the ability to access things off planet potentially that right. Wouldn't be feasible with other technologies, some of the communications advantages, some of the biotechnology advantages. In some cases, like you brought up the asteroid mining, these are new sources of abundance and resources.
Right. Yeah. Well, I mean, there's also a quality of life thing that you can't put a market value on, right? Right. Let's look at it this way. The military, when they invented radar really in the early 40s, they had no idea. It was by mistake that they realized you could actually cook food with it. They put these GIs would put their meals behind their radar system as it was firing up, and they would find out, hey, it keeps my hands warm. They didn't realize at the time probably wasn't a good idea. But my point is, look, now we have entire markets for microwave ovens. So you have a technology that was developed for one purpose and then later used for the benefit of the consumers, and that has improved all our lives, right? As a result of that, made our lives convenient, made it much more affordable in some cases. So I think, and of course, there's even in some cases, cancer treatment. So it's hard to put a dollar figure and value on something that has truly unlimited potential to improve the
solutions, yeah,
value of life, right? And the way we live our lives day to day and being able to extend and prolong our lives to a healthy, have a nice and healthy conclusion, ultimately.
We've heard potential health advantages, advanced materials with a wide range of capabilities, certainly energy and environmental communications. Right. I mean, so many of these fields of potential solutions. Going back into, because again, you were in some of these rooms that we haven't been. So the materials, you've mentioned some other areas. What other, I can ask you about them directly, but what other things do you think are most important out of the what you've seen on that side or other?
Well, certainly from my perspective, my background in medicine and microbiology and microorganisms, I'm fascinated by biology. I'm fascinated with the idea that life is, every time we try to put limitations or put life in a box, she always figures a way to wiggle herself out. When I was in school, I remember a very interesting anecdote that was shared with me. It was, if you look at modern humans, most anthropologists will say we've been around as Homo between 200,000 to 400,000 years. And if you compare that to a 24-hour clock, is really only the last 15 minutes, the last 2,000 years of our existence, and it was the Greeks that realized there were two fundamental forms of life on this planet, and you were either a plant or an animal, and humans fell under that animal category. And then it wasn't until the Renaissance, the days of enlightenment, where we realized there was this entire other form of life that's been sharing this planet all along that's neither plant nor animal, and it was the world of fungus. And of course, we tap ourselves on the shoulder, pat ourselves, clever little monkey. And it wasn't until the last 5 seconds of our existence, in that 24-hour clock, the last 120 years, where we had the technology, where we actually discovered the true dominant life form on this planet. In fact, if you add up all the biomass of every plant and the biomass of every animal and the biomass of every fungus and add it all together, it still doesn't add up to this hidden, completely hidden and yet true dominant life form on this planet. And it wasn't until we had the technology to curve glass and put it in a little metal tube and famously shout the words, little beasties, did we discover the world of microorganisms. Right.
So even what's inside, the life inside us, we didn't even recognize.
That's right.
But there's so much that's not recognized. It's always been here. And we didn't even recognize, it's like our own bodies.
We're always discovering what life can do. When I was growing up, I was taught incorrectly that all life had to derive its life support ultimately from photosynthesis. We know that's not true. If you go to the bottom of the oceans where the black smokers are, there's animals that thrive off of a process called chemosynthesis. We also thought that animals and all life form had to have oxygen. We were wrong there too, right? You have anaerobic life forms like Clostridium botulinum or botulism in this case that will actually die in the presence of oxygen. So we're constantly having to retool what it means to be alive. We thought, well, all life needs sunlight. No, it doesn't. Well, all life needs to be in the Goldilocks area of what we call the zone, habitable zone. Well, it turns out that we have extremophiles, life that can live in boiling water, life that can thrive on the outside of the skin of the ISS space station, where the radiation levels are off the charts, where the heat direct from the sun is off the charts. And then, of course, when the space station goes around Earth, it gets cold very quickly, where these life forms can thrive. They can thrive miles underneath the Arctic ice. And so we're constantly having to retune and recalibrate our very understanding of what it means to be alive.
And this resonates so much with scientists. So usually when we're talking to scientists, not that they're necessarily going on the record, but most often inquisitive scientists are telling us, well, we hope that there's life out there. Many of us would be surprised or shocked if there isn't, just based on the diversity of life in all these places on Earth. But yes, there's what people think with Drake equation of there's so many places life could exist. But then not many people have spoken to the more diversity of life that might be or is extraterrestrial or life off planet. I apologize. I didn't have a chance to reread your chapter on biologics. And I know that the book was probably went through clearance at DOD a year and a half ago. So you might know different things now. You might have learned or unlearned things. But what, since yeah. most people don't speak to that, is that an area you want to share more or make points?
Well, I mean, my point being is that I find we've always think that life has to be carbon-based, you know, what we call organic chemistry. And we look for signs of life because we compare it to what we know as life. But we have to really avoid that temptation because we're dealing with something potentially that wasn't derived from here. And so how do you measure it? Is it life? Can life be possible silicon-based? Well, I would submit to you that artificial intelligence may reach sentience at some point, and now we have it to redefine what life means. Because if you have something that's maybe not neurons connecting, but maybe microchips, but you reach this moment of criticality, you reach this critical mass where all of a sudden this computer becomes self-aware, this artificial intelligence now becomes self-aware. Is that life? Now, do we have to redefine what life means? And I think from a biology perspective, for me, there's also a case in point that life started here on Earth from somewhere else. In fact, if you look at this ball that we lived in, this rock that was forming together 4.5 billion years ago, it wasn't very habitable. Some scientists have proposed that, hey, transpermia, that life actually came from somewhere else in the cosmos. And just like a seed from a tree falls into a fertile little area and all of a sudden takes off. And that life really may not be unique. If you look at the numbers and the...
And Lou, your point on the carbon might not be the basis of the cell or whatever the organizing unit is. I mean, that's such a big thing you said right there. And it's like, whoa, Lou keeps saying that. There's a lot of other things, but that's a really big one. And so not to connect something that might not be related, but we have had people speak to us recently on intelligent materials. You know, and they've been willing to speak on that in a way that has become publicly disclosable. So that's not anything that we had to step into a skiff to get or anything like that. But so are fine if you're not weighing in on that or want to share on that. But listening to you and listening to others, I'm wondering, is there the knowledge or the active hypothesis that we do see something that appears like life that is non-carbon based?
It's certainly a possibility. We are, what I can say is what is in my book, what I've been clear to say is that we are in the possession of biologics, biologic samples. The specifics of those biologic samples, I'm not aware. I'm not a doctor. I wasn't given access to the actual results of it, but it seems very interesting. I think that if you look at the latest in science, there's something that we are developing right now, actually, a type of life form. And I think they call it mirror biology or something like that, that is basically a synthetic life form. You can type it in. We're about 10 years away from really having this, but immunologists are very concerned around the world because this is basically a new type of life form that our body wouldn't recognize as being life or as being a foreign body. And so therefore we have zero defense against it. And there was just a headline article about it yesterday about this. So we are, as humans, as clever little monkeys, if you look at I always tell people, if you look at the Darwinian scale of ape to man, we're still probably the third monkey on the left. We're not quite evolved yet, but we are in the process of potentially creating life right here that does not comport to any known standard of life. You know, I studied viruses for a very long time, and there was very serious discussion at one point by some world-leading virologists that a virus may in fact be extraterrestrial. It may not be from here because it does not have DNA. It does not have all the things, the telltale signs of life, and yet it reproduces and it can defend itself. It can do all the things that life seems to do, but there's nothing inside other than RNA, no DNA. So we're living in really interesting times. And I think science, I have this little graphic I put up when I give speeches sometimes, this Linus there from the Peanuts, and he's holding his blanket and he says, "Trusting the science is the most scientific statement one could ever make." Science is science because it questions previous practices. It challenges the status quo. And that's doing science, not just a bunch of academics getting into a room and saying, yeah, this is the way we're going to do things. Let's not forget the mistakes of what we did with Galileo when he first proposed a heliocentric model of our solar system, vice and earth-centric. They almost burned him at the stake for it. And yet it turned out he was right.
And so there are a lot of disruptive things, yeah, that was kind of seems really disruptive. So, I mean, and sometimes I get confused over who said what. So if you weren't involved in publicly any of this, just say, oh, yeah, I'm not in that camp. But obviously there's some of the crash retrieval stuff that's been coming out, including in those congressional testimony. There are a number of people who speak to craft are things that are visible, craft are things that might be in hand type stuff. We also work with scientists who are very interested in the energy and the communication side, among other areas, kind of some of the transmedium and just DC ultra high performance. What can you learn from it? Is there like a show and tell aspect to this? Should obviously when just as a chef, when they see something, they taste, they like it, they want to go home and cook it. Like we can tell you, like an artist sees something that might draw it. An engineer says, how do we build that? So there's plenty of people who are interested in how do we build that? Do you speak to any of those kind of the retrievals, the craft, or some of these energy or calm side?
Yeah, I am privy to it because of in my official capacity back when I was at the Pentagon, and then later on at the U.S. Space Force and some other efforts I probably can't talk about. But I am familiar with the crash retrieval. I have to be very careful. I will tell you that, and I said this openly to Congress, I signed a document maybe 4.5 years ago now that specifically said—
We're not trying to get you into anything that you can't—
No, but I'm just making it— No, absolutely, 100%. Yeah, no, I'm just— What I'm doing is— what I can tell you is what I'm telling you right now. I signed a document 4.5 years ago that said specifically I will never talk about crash retrievals. And it wasn't until I went through the official DOPSER process at the Pentagon to release my memoir— which, by the way, took almost a year to do, and they still redacted portions of it, was I allowed to even talk a little bit about it. But I actually signed documentation that if you know where to go to today, you can see where I signed my name saying I'll never discuss crash retrievals, and yet here we are discussing it, right? So times are changing. And I think openness and transparency, you talk to any academic, they're going to tell you, and even scientists, that's how you succeed. That's how you make major innovations, big step forward for our species, by sharing information. From a national security perspective, there's a great quote that my colleague, Chris Mellon, often says, we won the Cold War against the Soviet Union, not because we kept better secrets. We won the Cold War because we knew how to move information and secrets more efficiently and across the government than the Russians. There's value in knowledge and information.
We definitely don't want to make you share anything that our friends don't want you to share. But in terms of the things, because there are entrepreneurs and scientists listening, and it would really encourage people to read your book in depth. But if you say, this is the piece that's shareable, and I know what's well within bounds and where you can go right up to the edge. But what would you say? Listen to this. Like, go look at this, scientists, entrepreneurs. What would you point them to? That's shareable.
Well, let me be careful not to endorse anybody or anything specifically. We are at a very interesting precipice. We historically come to a crossroads and we have to decide to choose left or right. Right now, we're not at crossroads. We've got multiple options. We're kind of in the middle, if you will, of a compass and any direction we can go into. The world of quantum computing right now is beginning to really show value and in both scary and in positive ways. The world of medicine right now, same thing. There's some innovation there that I think very soon will be able to extend the life, quality of life, and the longevity of human beings. And which, by the way, if you want to go into space, that's probably a good idea, right? Because you got cover long distances and whatnot.
And we've certainly seen that intersection on the quantum and the UAP. We know people that are working at the intersection of quantum and UAP. I think we probably both know some of the same people and some different people that the other one doesn't know.
Correct.
But so are you saying that with regards to the UAP phenomena, quantum, and then biotechnology?
Yeah. And look, we just did an exercise with a quantum computer and it took 5 minutes for a computation that would have taken every computer in the world some septillion years to achieve, meaning there hasn't even been enough time in the universe since its creation for us to even try to solve this mathematical problem.
Well, that's exciting. Is that open and available?
Yeah, I'm telling you what was in the news this week. So every day we are making these, I often tell people we have evolved more in the last 120 years than we have in the last 120,000 years. It's been exponential. And that arc isn't going away. in 10 years from now, we're going to be living in a fundamentally new world where things like quantum computing and bioengineering is going to be the new norm. You, instead of going to a cosmetic surgeon to having a facelift, you might have a recombinant plasmid injected into you that will all of a sudden give you skin that's 30 years younger. These are advancements that are, this is not fantasy. We're getting very close to that. And I think your children and my children will be reaping some of the results of that, benefits of that. But of course, with that comes responsibility, because with everything that we do, there's always a side that you can do something very bad with. And we've seen that with, for example, nuclear technology. You can power.
And that's all technologies. The technology is neutral and then it can be used or not.
Correct. Correct. It's neutral. And it's us who have to be careful with what we do with it. A loaded handgun can help you hunt if you're starving, and or can also be used to hurt somebody. Same thing with a steak knife. So I would say also our in space is definitely huge. That's going to be, it's a very formidable environment. Humans don't do well in that hostile type environment, total vacuum and very cold and lots of radiation. But again, with some tweaking here and there of the human genome, we may find ourselves in 100 years much more resilient to radiation, perhaps, or perhaps living 200 years instead of maybe 80 years or 100 years. Being able to hack, if you will, the human body and the human experience. We're seeing it now with Elon Musk and other companies now that are putting chips into people's heads. Look, there's a poor fella out there. I'm not going to say he's poor fella anymore because he's beating everybody else, but this was a person who didn't have use of his arms, and I think he may have been quadriplegic. They put it implanted to his brain, and now he's playing Call of Duty, which is a game that just requires a lot of skill on the computer, and he's beating everybody because it's a direct brain interface from the brain to the computer. You don't need hands. You don't need reflexes. You don't need the time it takes, the milliseconds it takes for a signal to go from the brain to move your thumbs right or left. It's virtually instantaneous. And that's real. He's doing it right now. Anybody can get on a YouTube video and see this person play this game and play it very well. So we're already in a brave new world. We've already crossed that precipice. The question is, what does it look like? I think, you know, the real trick is not to, we're already going in a direction. It's to have bright enough headlights so we can see where we're actually going without being reactive, right? How great would it be, instead of walking around in a dark room and bumping into the closet and bumping into the doors and whatnot, if you actually had a light in there that could illuminate what you're seeing and what you're experiencing? I think the future is very much the same way in science. If we had the ability to project a little bit into the future, whether it's biology or space or anything else, that's where finance comes in, right? The financial world would love to have some sort of prediction.
Yeah. And you said that, and there are ways to do that. We've had, I don't know that we've had the speakers on in this. Well, we've had like Hal speak to some of the remote viewing and other programs. But yeah, so I guess there's a lot of what the future looks like. And you talk about the financing piece. And you said earlier there was a lot of taxpayer money that went into, and then I think you might have referenced, perhaps it was something different than the DIRD documents that Hal and others were involved with in one of those programs, the $22 million. But I would just say, as an innovation funder, that is a really low amount of money. So maybe you were speaking about a much larger budget than that, I would hope.
Yes, a much, much larger. A tip was what I consider budget dust. Not to say, people say, $22 million is a lot of money. It is. And we made sure every penny counted. And even when we didn't have money, we still made sure every penny counted. But my point being is that, yes, it's budget dust. If you really want to make real innovation, you have to have real investment. And that's just the fact of life. And it's always been that way. It's not an American thing.
I was going to say, for instance, like in climate or energy, the Inflation Reduction Act alone was in the bipartisan infrastructure. I mean, that was well into the trillions, and individual programs in some cases on the energy terrestrial side. So not space involved at all, or hundreds of billions of dollars. So just the point that when the $5 million answer is very different than the $500 million answer, right, and the $5 billion answer, when the leadership is extending lives by 100 years, resolving disease, cleaner resources, better fuel efficiencies, whatever.
Think of the productivity that you can get as a result of a single
$1 trillion markets that we or other countries lead. So yes, you better be putting billions of dollars up.
Correct.
From your already successful portfolio.
If you look at a human being, if you look at an average human being's life, let's say here in America, let's just say for argument's sake, it's 80 years. It may not be blood, but let's just say 80 years. So for the first 20 years, we're busy growing up. And for the last 20 years, we're busy retiring. So really your years of productivity are going to be about 40 years. Now, imagine if you had the ability to extend the human life beyond what it normally is. So now you still have your 20 years of growth and 20 years of retirement, but now you've got 160 years of productivity, right? Now that's real value that can be economically measured and say, wow, holy crap. Now you're not spending a quarter of your life in a nursing home in bad health. You're only spending maybe a tenth of your life or maybe 5% of your life, where the rest is you're healthy and you're producing. So I do.
That's an amazing vision, Lou. I think that calling the math out that way, that's very helpful.
Well, it is. It's simple math. I mean, that's where you look. Investment is nothing more than a willingness to gamble on something. That's what a lot of investment is. Let's face it, you're gambling. You're hoping that you have the right people to do something that will ultimately lead to some sort of improvement and maybe even financial gain. Those are very real, tangible things that can be invested by governments, by individuals, by organizations, institutions.
Well, there's the weighted probability. So that is the, right. The probability adjusted kind of expectation, and that portfolio approach of being able to craft a portfolio where you understand that not everything in life works out, but that you do need to undertake new projects, new initiatives, along with existing ones, in order to keep moving forward, whether that's just the maintenance or, of course.
Hey, even biologically, not every mutation is good, right? Most of them are bad, but all you need is a couple of good mutations, you know, in a species. And now they've evolved into something that can thrive instead of just survive. So
in early stage portfolios, it is very much that 5% is what carries all the portfolio from the financial
100%,
standpoint.
100%.
And the point is, people spend way too much time worrying about what to stay out of, whereas the reality is the highest performing portfolios, you can't stay out of things that aren't financially performing, which they can still be very valuable, but aren't financially performing. You can stay out of the high performing ones, though, by not doing them. But there's more avoidance of benefit, unfortunately, going on in some investment circles, because you don't avoid I don't want to call them failures, but not every company is the top company in a space.
I'll give you a perfect example of that. And I'm not going to say who this was from. It's a little bit funny, but here's a perfect example. A friend of mine who does a lot of investing, he has a means to do it, is always trying to find the next best thing. And so there was this drug company that was doing something, I believe it was for your heart. And they were doing all these tests and tests. And ultimately, at the end of the day, it failed to do anything for your heart. But what it wound up becoming was Viagra.
And so, I'm familiar with that one.
Right. So that's
a hard story to follow.
It is a joke there somewhere. You're right. And so there is always options to take a failure and turn it into a success. What is failure? Well, you have to define it, because not every failure is necessarily really a failure. It's just maybe it's not an obvious success at the moment that it's pioneered. And that is the spirit, I think, of that we need to look at in this topic with UAP.
So there is the ecosystem, right? So while not every company is the leading company, there is that mix of people who are forwarding the capabilities, who are engaging, who are adding to that intellectual property, that talent, that workforce, that zeitgeist. And I know in our own, the portfolios I've worked with at NSF, so they've gone well over 10x as a portfolio level. So several of these companies, 100x, 200x, and even the early years in the portfolio, 10x portfolio level. So for people that have abilities to craft such portfolios, the opportunity to take on a range of new initiatives, not just this space, because in our case, UAP-related things are less than 5%, but some of these areas of leading technology, it's that if it works out, it drives tremendous capability and it becomes that much higher performing portfolio. And if it doesn't work out, you're still at a relatively high performing mix.
Right. There's a lot of derivative benefits. A lot of derivative benefits. I agree with you wholeheartedly. There's another, for example, there was a test we wanted to do. No, I could talk about it, I guess. We wanted to test, see if we could detect UAP coming in using infrasonics. Were there low acoustic signatures that we could use to detect UAP coming in, just like we can with asteroids or ICBMs, right? And things like that coming into Earth orbit. And if so, could we then use that for other things to detect as well, using that same type of infrasonics. There's a lot of derivative value. Definitely. When you invest into something that you're maybe not quite sure what the end result's going to be, but there's a lot of paths that could lead to some very good things. And so I would encourage anybody who's, I am not a financial advisor.
I would just affirm what you're saying. I mean, so like the NSF program that I've worked with over the decades, it's catalyzed companies that have gone on to achieve over $300 billion in market capitalization just on the top. These are, and a lot of times we don't have visibility into who's done what. So that's when I think it's acquired. So one company got acquired, for instance, by SpaceX, which is a big part of their Starlink. And we just look at that as the acquisition value, not what it drives within the larger corporation. So yeah. I think that we see so many cases across the private sector and across the government where it's this willingness to take on investment and risk in people who want to build things, because the private sector, the innovators, the entrepreneurs, they're capable of so many things, but it does require support. It requires capital. It requires openness. And right. If you want to see any of these markets flourish, the availability of capital is fundamental.
Well, can you imagine? Let's look at another example here. The very first steam engine was really just an oddity. All it was a little sphere that had a little look like a pitot tube. You fill it with water and you put it under fire, and under the steam, it would spin. And it was a little steam engine, and it was a curiosity. Nobody knew what they could ever use it for. Okay. Lo and behold, centuries later, you have the Industrial Revolution. And look what that steam power, being able to convert water into steam, which is a 1 × 10³ release in volume of energy, 1,700 times its volume, has led to great innovation, whether it was the printing press on a mass scale or steamboats or the locomotive or electricity. We're still using steam today, even with nuclear power plants, to create electricity to this day, right? And so...
And steel and silicon.
You know. Absolutely. I mean, that's just one small example. We go on and on.
It's kind of these things that people say, could you use it for anything, or why?
Right. Yeah. Imagine that first person to see the steam engine and the investor saying, nah, I don't see any value there. What? Wait a minute. don't let that little steam engine fool you. There's the ability for that proof of concept will radically change mankind forever, humankind forever. And that is what investors need to understand. That tiny little investment here can go a long way. Yes, you might just have yourself a little steam engine, but that's going to lead to an entire revolution for our species.
Well, and the thing I would say, Lou, is like from the investor standpoint, there might be people that want to do just this, but then there's also the opportunity that when you have portfolios that are high performing, this can be taken on under a portfolio approach where it also serves as whether it's a hedge or a source of upside. Just kind of, there are many capital sources they could look at this as need to be here to have a piece of the flow on where things might be going so that they're ready when those larger stage investments come through. Right. Or that importance of just putting it in the mix like any of these other areas. Oftentimes when people have exposure early on, they do very well in those initial investments, but also they're in a different position and market expansion takes place.
Right. And we already know, by the way, from a competition perspective, we already know other countries are looking to this topic very heavily and they're investing in it. So let's not fool ourselves. The race is on. That the gun already fired.
We've had some people recently naming them. Did we ask you to name them on this call? We say name names, which countries, because people need to know. You don't need to say if you're not able to say. We've had other people stating and they're the approach to make the investment for what might.
There's a lot right now. There are some major investors in overseas that are looking into this topic, trying to figure out where they want to put their money. So it's the race is on. I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing, but
in the U.S. as well. I mean, so I'm not going to speak to it. There's some very big names that are in this already or who are kind of doing the diligence, taking a look at it, figuring out.
Hey, let's not forget.
They want to step in.
This new administration, again, politics aside, I'm apolitical, but this new administration, there's a lot of key people in cabinet positions that are very well aware of this topic. Let me just say that. Right. And this could be a very friendly time for investors to get the wink, wink, nudge, nudge from government to say, yeah, you know what? We'd like you to invest in this. This is something that could be very beneficial. There are some big allies in the new administration? Again, politics aside, whether you love somebody or hate somebody or in the middle, doesn't matter. From a corporate and financial perspective, there's a target here for sure, a target of opportunity that probably should not be missed.
And do you see a lot of, because what we hear a lot of it is from the people in the private sector, do you hear a lot of, we see people showing up and asking and they want to get on calls. And we try to democratize that so that more people know what's going on. Say, hey, it's public and it's shareable. So let's make this available so that if people want to be there, they go there as opposed to just being blindsided, right? So, but you've been traveling all over the country. So are you seeing a lot of that investor, entrepreneur?
Yeah, I've had them come to some of my shows and have dinner with me. And I won't name names, but people who have the means, who are very well known publicly, public figures. You'd be surprised if some of them, though, if I mentioned their names, you'd probably go, really? Yeah.
They're not surprised.
Yeah, maybe not. There's a tremendous amount of interest from people, from very well-established families that go back decades and generations that have a history of investing in things that turn out to be wildly successful. You have some entrepreneurs in Silicon Valley that are very interested. You have people, like I said, from politicians to scientists, academics, entrepreneurs, even in the IT world, believe it or not. They see a lot of opportunity here. They see some long-term gains by getting involved in this topic. Again, at some point, my hope would be for them to come out and speak to you, not me. But that's happening right now.
Well, if there's somebody that you want to make an introduction to, I mean, depending on the content, you're happy to see if it makes sense in whatever format. But I do think...
Yeah,
I do
there's think some that are very reputable. If I told you some of the names, I think you'd probably... Well, again, maybe you wouldn't be shocked. But, you know, these are people that I think would be people that have supported the NSF, National Science Foundation, for a long time. You wouldn't think would be really tied to this topic are. And some big folks overseas in Europe that are really making a difference over there.
Well, I've been hearing about this, I don't know if I've mentioned, for 15 years or more. So I think that just the flow of information, the openness, it's changed so much. So some of these entities you're talking about have just, it's great that you've made it so available to people across the country, right? Because you're going out there and you're saying, you're sharing that flow of opportunity and information.
But you are
to
too.
Extend this to more people.
Let's give credit where credit is due.
People who are in the know, but you're opening those doors for more people so that people who haven't been in those rooms, they can decide whether they want to step into those rooms.
I certainly appreciate that, but let's give credit where credit is due. You and your colleagues are also doing a hell of a job. I cannot remember a time where 10 years ago, certainly when I was in the Pentagon, this conversation would ever have happened. So we are only here in this conversation because the group is making it happen. It's not Lou Elizondo. It's all of us making this work. And you and your colleagues have a huge amount of credit as well to take. You are responsible in many ways for this transformation you're seeing. This, for me, is probably the greatest aspect of this topic. This is a topic that has united Congress, believe it or not, has actually brought opposite sides together of all topics. Can you imagine? Everything in D.C. is partisan, except this. This topic, and same with the scientific community. You have organizations like the Galileo and folks at Stanford and even Oxford now that are having this conversation. I've given talks at Emory-Riddle University and other universities around the United States where professors of physics and their students are interested to say, hey, listen, we want to know. Are there any type of STEM?
People want to know, Lou. They want to know, and sometimes they want to know, and sometimes they know, and they just want to share. You know, and they say, oh, good, we can talk about this. We're talking about this now?
Right.
Yeah, and Lou, I'm very interested in your opinion. So I agree with you on politics aside, the new administration coming in seems to offer a great opportunity for space, right? And for, in many cases, more kind of open sharing, more kind of transparent kind of lens on information and other assets. If we think about some of those assets and information that are locked down or that have been the result of kind of decades of kind of stigma and secrecy, what might you prioritize for the new administration? What would we like to see opening up so that scientists and innovators and students, right? Just folks can start to understand re-engineer and or reverse engineer and build?
What a thoughtful question. I have never been asked that before. Thank you so much. If I was back in the government tomorrow and I had the authority to make just one decision, what I would do is lower the threshold of what is classified. So more can be available to academia and universities and the general public. Look, when you crowdsource something, you get a lot more eyes, a lot more ears, a lot more brain power on a solution. And I've always believed in, as it was said earlier, democratizing this topic. And so what I would do is force any information about this topic, once it's 25 years old, unless there's actually a real no kidding national urgency, national security urgency, I'd make it all unclassified, all of it. And let the university, then I would go ahead, I would do government grants and incentivize people to do research in this, even if it went nowhere, that's okay. As you said, sometimes you've got to break the eggs to make an omelet, and sometimes
you're it's learning, right? Even if it goes nowhere, you're learning
right.
something.
And you'll never know because, like the steam engine, it may come back around and wind up revolutionizing something, right? It may
exactly. Be, there's serendipity.
Right.
Yeah,
that's right. So
you can't block it out because, like I said, we didn't come here to this conversation out of a specific UAP interest. And 15 years ago, I was in the private sector. It was kind of, what do you do with this? But we came back to it because we saw that integration with so many fields of technology.
Yeah.
So it's not possible to box it out, right? We can't stay away from the underlying phenomena, the advanced physics, while still progressing in these areas.
I would create, even go as far as creating like a Project Manhattan project, but for peaceful purposes, and bring in the best and brightest around the academic community, the scientific community, create almost like a national lab construct and say, here you go, guys, here's your pot of money, go have fun and figure this out. Work with CERN and the Large Hadron Collider and work with Ames and everybody else. And let's start turning this into some sort of useful product for humanity.
Right.
And there's so much optimism in space right now, both sides of the aisle. I mean, it's recognized that this incoming administration, the Trump administration, has already done so much in space in the past. So whether it's going back to the moon, whether it's the Space Force. So there's a lot of excitement about what can bring everybody nationally together, because there's so many good people on both sides of the aisle that are just ready to get things done, but believe that impetus, from what we understand, is expected to be there.
Yeah, I concur.
Not just on promises, but on prior performance, right?
Yeah, I concur. There's all sorts of things you could do if you wanted to allow people. You said these things called war bonds back in World War II and before that, where people could put their money to something that they really believed in, and it was backed by the U.S. government. You could do something like that too for this topic, right? Say, hey, look, if you're interested, buy some space bonds, right? That allow us to really cutting edge research and invest in a particular part of America that you really love, right? That you believe in. That's another option that could be done fairly easily. And you'd have a lot of investment and a lot of people, a lot of stuff flowing through that. These are some easy things that could be done, I think, that probably, you know, wouldn't be much of a heavy lift.
Yeah. Need it yesterday, right? Some of these. Yeah,
right. Exactly.
Yeah, we can't move fast enough. When it's a race, people know how to move. It's on.
Yep. Agreed. 100%.
Well, I think what we need to do is just kind of get all of this in front of the right decision makers, right? And just continue chasing this conversation so that we kind of keep this at the top of the priority list as the new administration comes in and starts making decisions, starts to allocate resources, a strategic resource allocation and prioritization. The work that you've been doing, the conversation that you've been leading, has been just invaluable. Right. We need to engage in more of a national conversation about what we know, what we're seeing, but don't understand, what's possible, and what the new unimpossible opportunities are.
Well, so, I appreciate that very much. And I'll leave you with a couple of thoughts. I would submit to you that impossible is just something we haven't seen yet. Yeah. And I would also leave you with this, that you
are operational, right, Lou? Some would say it's operational.
That's right. You always have an advocate with me. If there's anything I can ever do, this is my passion, especially as it involves education and scientific innovation. You will always have me as a very vocal advocate. If there's anything I can ever do for you, please let me know. I will always make myself available.
We're getting together with the innovators mid next week, and you've got an invitation. And many leaders across the private sector have an invitation and government. So we see that people want to engage in the conversation and people are coming together on this. And we're grateful that you spoke today and you're certainly invited next week as well.
Great. Appreciate that. Thank you so much, folks. It's been truly my honor and privilege. And I don't say that lightly. It really is. And if I can be of use in any capacity, please let me know.
Well, actually, you could be in one way. We would like to license the out-of-towners technology.
That's right. There are these rooms where people are saying, is it real? We're saying, we're past that conversation.
It's real. Hey, for sure.
We're funding it. We're helping drive it forward. We're trying to find the people who want to do it. So as Larry says, we're ready to license. We're ready to move. We work with the people who are just like, all right, how do we get one of these? How do we get 10 of these? Can you scale it up to 1,000? Right? That's the world we operate in.
Right. Well, I like it. And like I said, if I can help you in any way, count me in.
Thanks. You got it. You're on our speed dial. All right. So another amazing conversation. So thanks again, everyone, for joining us today. And please do check out this season's new episodes as we explore the convergence of innovation, technology, and refactor business models and the new unimpossible missions, and how this convergence is reshaping industry, policy, and society, and what it means for all our collective ecosystemic futures. Follow us and subscribe on Apple Podcasts or your favorite place to access podcasts, and you can always learn more at shushandworks.com. Thanks, everyone.
Thanks so much.